you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Iran says it will reverse its scale-back of 2015 nuclear deal commitments only after all other signatories to the deal implement their obligations. WHO experts investigating the origins of COVID-19 dismiss a theory that the virus was leaked from a lab in the Chinese city of Wuhan. And China slams joint exercises by two U.S. warships in the South China Sea as a show of force that is not conducive to regional peace. Welcome to World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Top story, Iran saying it will reverse the scale back of the 2015 nuclear deal commitments after all other signatories to the deal implement their obligations.
I'm announcing that any hour when the 5 plus 1, any hour that 5 plus 1 starts adhering and complying with the JCPOA commitments, they should know that in the next hour we will also comply with our commitments.
Rouhani made a comment in an address to foreign ambassadors in Tehran on the eve of the 42nd anniversary of the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. He said that it was not Iran that withdrew from the agreement and therefore should not be expected to take the first step. Rouhani says that Tehran remained fully committed to the deal more than a year after the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Iran began reducing its commitments after the European signatories failed to deliver on their promise of ensuring that a country benefits from the deal. The president also criticized the new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden for its failure in facilitating Iran's access to medical equipment and pharmaceuticals in the face of the pandemic.
And till today, we have not seen any appropriate measure by the new U.S. administration. The new U.S. administration that claims it wants to combat COVID-19 and help other countries for countering the COVID-19 pandemic. So far, it has conducted no action.
Rouhani said that Iran faced the toughest circumstances in dealing with the coronavirus due to the illegal and cruel sanctions during the former U.S. administration. Iran was denied access to its funds to purchase medical equipment and pharmaceuticals. However, the president said that the country grew self-reliant in producing the required equipment and vaccines. He also touched upon other regional issues, including foreign intervention that is at odds with the interests of West Asian nations. Rouhani stressed that the region should resolve its issues on its own. A member of Germany's left party, Bijan Tavassoli, says that U.S. President Joe Biden must demonstrate in action his departure from the illegal policies of his predecessor.
The position of Iran on this issue is now crystal clear, and every other nation knows how they can deal with this, and especially the United States. They were the ones that broke the accord, and so it's on them to re-implement all the provisions of the JCPOA and to lift the illegal sanctions. And as soon as they do that, they can expect that the Islamic Republic of Iran will honor its international commitments. But these commitments do not exist in a state where the United States is just in complete disalignment with its provisions that it has agreed to. So first of all, Joe Biden needs to realize that he cannot just criticize President Trump on the campaign trail, but he has to have actions. And these actions actions that speak louder than words need to show that he breaks with the illegal moves of his predecessor and implements a White House policy that respects international law.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned the Belgian envoy to Tehran to lodge an official protest against the recent sentencing of an Iranian diplomat. A ministry statement says it's a strongly protested the court ruling in the Belgian city of Antwerp that handed down a 20-year jail term to Assadullah Assadi. The ministry called the verdict illegal and that it had not only violated international law but also ignored Belgium's obligations toward Iran. The statement says that Iran does not recognize the verdict and wants Belgium to immediately release the diplomat. Assadi is accused of plotting to bomb a meeting of the anti-Iran terror group MKO in France in June 2018. The foreign ministry says that Assadi's case is an MKO plot to damage relations between Tehran and Europe. Since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, the MKO has conducted many assassinations and bombings targeting officials and civilians. Now let's take a look at Afghanistan. At least nine government employees and security personnel have been killed in a string of militant attacks, including in the capital, Kabul. Police say the gunman opened fire on a vehicle carrying the staff of the Minister of Rural Development, leaving four of them dead. Elsewhere, a bomb ripped through a foreign ministry vehicle in the capital, killing the driver. Also on Tuesday, four security forces were killed, and another one was wounded after their vehicle struck a roadside bomb in Herat province. No group has claimed responsibility for the attacks. The country has seen a spike in bomb and gun attacks in recent months, despite an ongoing peace negotiation between the Taliban and the government in Doha. Now, in other news, the British Health Secretary says that the UK will tighten border controls from mid-February to help guard the country against the new COVID variants.
First, Mr. Speaker, we're setting up a new system of hotel quarantine for UK and Irish residents who've been in red list countries in the last 10 days. In short, this means that any returning residents from these countries will have to quarantine in an assigned hotel room for 10 days from the time of arrival. Before they travel, they'll have to book through an online platform and pay for a quarantine package costing £1,750 for an individual travelling alone, which includes the hotel, transport and testing. This booking system will go live on Thursday, when we'll also publish the full detailed guidance. Second,
Now, Hancock also said that there will be fines and possible jail terms for those not complying with new anti-COVID rules. He noted that the lifting of restrictions would mostly depend on the performance of vaccines against the new variants. Underplanned arrivals will have to quarantine in assigned hotels at their own expenses. The government says it has secured 4,600 hotel rooms for that purpose and will provide more if needed. The UK currently is battling with a new highly transmissible variant. The country is the most affected in Europe, with almost 4 million cases and 112,000 related deaths so far. WHO experts have dismissed the controversial theory that the coronavirus was leaked from a laboratory in the Chinese city of Wuhan.
The findings suggest that the laboratory incident hypothesis is extremely unlikely and to explain the introduction of the virus into the human population, and therefore is not an a hypothesis that will suggest, that will implies to suggest future studies into our work to support our future work into the understanding of the origin of the virus.
The WHO team has been in China over the past 2 weeks probing the origins of the pandemic. They say there is no indication of the transmission of COVID-19 in Wuhan before December 2019. The virus could have been circulating in other regions before it was identified in Wuhan last year. The team also says identifying the animal pathway remains a work in progress. The virus is believed to have originated in bats and then transmitted to humans via another mammal. Time now for the news review program. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome to the News Review. Russia says it views members of an anti-corruption foundation established by jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny as agents of the Western Military Alliance, NATO. The foreign ministry spokeswoman says that Navalny's allies met with representatives of the European Union, the U.S. and the U.K. and received instructions on how to disrupt Russian politics. Maria Zakharova says that they were also found discussing with the West about potential sanctions against the Russian political figures. And those comments follow tit-for-tat expulsions of several European and Russian diplomats as tensions are running high over Navalny's alleged poisoning and his recent imprisonment. He was arrested in January after returning from Germany, where he was receiving treatment. His arrest also triggered unauthorized street protests in a number of cities. Time for some insight and some elaboration on that issue. Joining me will be Fred Ware, journalist and commentator from Moscow, and also Paolo Raffone, secretary of the CIPI Foundation in Brussels. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Over to Moscow. Fred, could you tell us first a little bit about this anti-corruption foundation and actually who Alexei Navalny is? Do you agree with the stance announced by Moscow?
Well, no, not completely. The anti-corruption foundation is founded by Navalny, but it is autonomous. It works. It has its own people who do investigative journalism. They dig up stories and illustrations, documentation of things that even in Russia are considered to be corrupt practices on the part of officials. Navalny does his videos, which are very very colorful and illustrative. And this has always been considered a bit of a thorn in the side of the authorities. Navalny himself, as a political figure in the last few weeks, put himself in direct confrontation with Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. He made that very clear in his own statement before the court, that he is like David to Putin's Goliath or something like this, which brought, this is Russia, a rather heavy-handed response from the authorities. Navalny's got a prison sentence. Three EU diplomats were expelled for being present at street protests. And it's okay. And I mean, in my view, I'm a journalist, and we're sort of treated as diplomats or semi-diplomats. You're supposed to observe, but you should not be a participant. And these three were accused of participating in these rallies. I don't know what the truth of that is, but this has really severely worsened relations between the EU and Russia.
Now let me ask Paolo. Talking about Navalny, Moscow does not have a good impression of Navalny, and there are talks of schemes and some certain agenda backed by the West. And what is the point? Why is there so much fuss when it comes to any story about Navalny? The Western world, especially the U.S., starts such a hue and cry.
Well, the history of Navalny is quite known. Actually, he's quite a controversial figure in Russian environment. His origin, his race to power and money, and his engagement for the defense of rights and the fight against corruption. But it has been accompanied by a number of glitches in his own life and connections. So he is quite a controversial figure. He is looked at as a sort of defender of freedom of expression in Russia, but as a matter of fact, he is quite of a marginal figure because out of Moscow and St. Petersburg, he is pretty unknown as a political figure. His weight altogether is quite low, a few percentage points. Mm-hmm. So we cannot see him as an oppositor, a serious oppositor to the regime in Russia. The West has been investing on him because it's a way to embarrass the current presidency of Russia on issues which do exist, like corruption, as it was mentioned. I mean, even the authorities admit that there is corruption. So, but to see this as a possibility of creating a revolution in Russia, I mean, we are on the wrong track. It's evident that this will not happen.
Fred, is Russia doing the same thing that the U.S. is doing in terms of an opposition figure like Navalny?
How do you mean?
I mean, they are putting him under the spotlight, and whatever happens, they give it a full coverage, and they, you know, back him openly. And Russia doesn't seem to be doing this. I mean, somebody like Navalny within the U.S. administration.
No, that's true. The Russians are much more proper diplomatically. I mean, they get accused of this interfering in U.S. elections and all that. It's more difficult to sort through the truth and falsehood and imaginings that do go on in the American minds. But no, Russia doesn't send its diplomats to attend Black Lives Matter protests or issue kind of inflammatory statements, show sympathies for particular political figures in the United States. And if they did, you would really hear their response. But no, the Navalny issue is complicated. I ask a lot of Russians. I know a lot of people. I live here a long time. Mm-hmm. And I ask them, do you think that Navalny is a traitor? And I have not met a single Russian, including, you know, fairly high-ranking people, journalists and so on, who say, yes, I think he's a traitor. But it doesn't mean that most people like him. I agree with the previous guest's assessment that he's a marginal figure. The latest Levada trust poll, ranking politicians by trust, mm-hmm. gives him 5% people who would volunteer his name and say, I trust the guy.
Right.
That's a big improvement for Navalny, but it's still really small in the order of things. He's not that kind of a threat. He's more like a canary in the coal mine or something uh-huh. in Russia. It is important the way he gets treated and the way his supporters are able to express themselves. But one thing I think all Russians agree with, not necessarily that he's an agent of foreign powers, but in calling for sanctions, which is what Navalny's organization, Anti-Corruption Fund, is doing, they are lobbying Western governments to impose sanctions on Russia, on Russian individuals, Russian leaders. That crosses a line for a lot of Russians that I talk to.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and contribution. We had Fred Ware, journalist and commentator out of Moscow. Also, Paolo Raffone, secretary of the CIPI Foundation in Brussels.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Face to Face.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Face to Face. I'm Houman Abedi, and in this program, I'm going to have an interview with Iran's energy minister, Dr. Reza Ardakhanian, who is here with us to share his thought with us. Dr. Ardakhanian, thank you very much for accepting invitation. As the first question, please explain in general about the achievements of your ministry, especially after the victory of the Islamic Revolution back in 1979 in the field of water and electricity supply to remote areas of the country.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to be with you. Ministry of Energy in Iran is in charge of water and electricity. In general, means thermal power plants, hydropower plants, and renewable energy. And when it comes to the water, it's about constructing and managing large dams, as well as irrigation and drainage networks. Also distributing water for different sectors, for domestic, in urban and rural areas, also for agriculture, for industries, and providing water for environmental protection. My ministry also collects wastewater and try to treat them and reusing treated wastewater. So all in all, this ministry deals with each and everyone in the country, in urban areas, in rural areas, and day and night we have to provide enough safe and clean and secure water as well as electricity for the whole population. 42 years ago, when Islamic Revolution came on stage, and we started to serving our people in different way. That time, the installed capacity in terms of power plants was just about 7,000 megawatts in the country. And nowadays, while population is 2.3 times the installed capacity of power plants is about 12 times than that time. So it means that we have achieved a good level of progress as well as facilities, not only for domestic purposes, but also for development of the country in different area because of the role of energy as an infrastructure. Also, we have started recently working on renewable energies in terms of wind and solar. For sure, 42 years ago, it was zero. And now we have about 870 megawatts of solar and wind renewable energy. And in terms of hydro, also we have established many large dams with hydropower facilities, and I think it's more than 12,000 megawatts, while this number was less than 2,000 40 years ago. This has provided us a good infrastructure in the country, and also in terms of water, if we look at the statistics worldwide, this time in the urban areas, the coverage in the world is about 96%. For electricity in Iran is 100%. And in rural areas, for electricity, the coverage worldwide is about 79%. In Iran is 99.7%. So it means almost each and everyone in the country has access to electricity. When it comes to the water, the situation even is more brighter. Mm-hmm. And I may say 42 years ago, we had just four wastewater treatment plants in the country located in four major cities, and none of them was able to cover the whole city. And it I think less than 2 million population were covered by wastewater treatment plants. Just a few days ago, our president inaugurated, among many other projects, one of the high-tech wastewater treatment plant in Kurdistan province in Kamyaran. And it was number 246, means that we have designed and constructed and operated 242 wastewater treatment plant during these 4 decades. But most of the progress came during the last 7-8 years. And now we are in the position of reporting that every month we are inaugurating one wastewater treatment plant. Every 2 months we are inaugurating one water treatment plant. And every 50 days, less than a month, during the last 7 years, we have inaugurated and operated a new large dams. So this means that Iran is in a good shape in terms of infrastructure for water and electricity.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your thorough answer. Would you please tell us more about the progress of the Ministry of Energy in recent years in terms of export of energy, especially, I mean, electricity to other countries?
So when we have established power plants 12 times than it was 40 years ago, while the population has been increased just less than 2.5 times, it means that we have invested a lot for the network. So we are in a good location in terms of geography. We have good connection with all neighboring countries. I may say from southeast with Pakistan, then Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Turkey, Iraq, which with each and every neighboring countries, we have electricity connection. Exporting, importing, it depends on the time of the year. In some cases, we are just exporter. In some cases, we have transaction of energy in different months of the year. And we think that in the near future, we may also bring renewable energy in this network to be exported to the neighboring countries. We have announced to all investors in private sector that we provide them permission and access to our network that they export their own, say, electricity generated by wind towers and solar panels to the neighboring countries based on the contracts they sign with them. So I think right now we are in a good shape. If ourselves do not need electricity, we can, I mean, provide it to neighboring countries. And in some cases, we are importing when we need them.
Thank you. Today we are witnessing the export of technical knowledge of Iranian specialists abroad. Can you please elaborate that in which countries we have implemented or we are implementing projects both independently or jointly with other countries?
Look, in the world, usually they remember Iran as a country with major sources of oil and gas as the source of wealth in this country. But in reality, our major wealth is our human resources. And if we utilize this source in a right way in terms of education, training, and using human resources in the right places, I think we are good enough not only to respond to the needs of our country, but also we may have a major role in development and progress of the region. As you mentioned, many Iranian contractors and consulting engineers right now are active in the region, even outside our region. They are working in Africa, and they are winning the bids for major projects in terms of designing and building large dams, hydropower plants, thermal power plants. It's now, I believe, 6 years consecutively that Ministry of Energy of Iran means that water and electricity sector in Iran is in the first place in terms of exporting technical services and engineering services worldwide. So we have thousands of companies now are active in building equipments in energy sector, and many companies both in consulting engineering area as well as contractors working on large dams, on designing and constructing water and wastewater treatment plants. This is another source for employment and also for a good level of friendship and connection, especially with the neighboring countries.
Can you please tell us the name of some of these countries that currently Iran is implementing?
So we have worked and we are working in Iraq, mainly in the energy sector, while also in other part of development in Iran. In Iraq, Iranian companies are active. Minister of Energy now, based on the decision of the Iranian government, is in charge of Joint Economic Commission between Iran and different countries. I myself am in charge with Iraq, with Armenia, Russian Federation, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, as well as State of Qatar in the region, and some other countries like Sri Lanka outside our region. So in Iraq, we have major projects, mainly in the energy sector, but also in other part in construction of sport fields, as well as dam construction. In Tajikistan, we have constructed hydropower plants, also working on the road construction and connecting different parts of the countries in terms of using TBMs for tunnel projects. In Sri Lanka, the Iranian companies have designed and constructed and operated a major hydropower plants. Soon will be officially inaugurated by officials of both countries. In Africa, many Iranian private sector companies are active in different projects.
Very well. Dr. Ardakhanian, many say that the world's future war would be over water. And in face of water scarcity across the globe, what are the energy ministry's mechanisms to cope with this issue?
If many say and talk about war on the water, so it means that not all the people, and some of them do not talk about the war, and I am among those people who are not a believer in the war on the water. And instead, I think that those people who are talking about the war on the water in the future, they are somehow paving the way for some potential conflicts. And they want to normalize this issue of conflicts on the water then they go for fishing themselves out of these potential conflicts. But regardless of this argument, Iran is in a very unique situation worldwide in terms of shared water and inter-boundary basin issues. We have many countries in the world that they are in living in the inter-boundary basins in terms of water and sharing water with their neighboring countries. But they all are either upstreamer or downstreamer. If they are downstreamer, like for example in MENA region, like a big country like Egypt, they know what to do as a downstreamer, right? And this position affects on different area in terms of even engineering, mathematical modeling, and so on. And some countries are upstreamer, and they know how to deal with the issue. But Iran is a country that is upstreamer, at the same time is a downstreamer. In the east part of the country, we are in the downstream of inter-boundary basin with our neighbors, Afghanistan. In the west part of the country, we are in the upstream of the basin with our neighbor, Iraq. Also, we have shared rivers in the north, northeast, northwest. We have Harirud River with Turkmenistan. We have Aras River with Armenia and Azerbaijan. So it means that Iran is in a very unique situation in terms of dealing with different aspects of the shared water and living in the inter-boundary basin. Is this a challenge? Yes. But also it's an opportunity. And if we do things in a correct way, if we rely on water scarcity as a source of being closer and closer and working on it as an opportunity for friendship and cooperation, then we come to the point to say that either a scarcity of water or somehow droughts and this kind of climate situation is not in a source of being worried when it comes to dealing with the neighboring countries. We can open new chapters and working with our neighbors to share benefits and cost of water. We can look at the water as a source of cooperation. When we have flood, when we are facing droughts, both of them can be used as the reasons to work closer with the neighboring areas. So recently we have started to establish a national center for shared water and inter-boundary basin issues to, improve the level of cooperation, first of all, at the national level between different ministries and authorities, and then going to our neighboring countries and offering many different projects for cooperation. So in the long run, I think we can take advantage of water scarcity in our region to work closely with our neighboring countries and share whatever of the knowledge and experience and technical expertise that we have with our neighbors. And I think it will help us to overcome the negative aspect of water scarcity. So all in all, I do not believe in war on water.
And are all of our neighbors willing to cooperate in this regard?
When it comes to development, we should know that the main aspects of development is the human resources development. I mean, building dams, power plants, roads, and other facilities and infrastructures alone is not the sign of development. The major and main development aspects in the mind of the people. That's why that right now in the world they do not divide the regions or the countries to developed and developing. And they talk about the people. Either I am a developed citizen worldwide or I am a developing. So we have to invest and work more on education and training. And I'm sure that in our region with lots of cultural connection that we have with our neighbors, we can build upon that bridge and work together. I may say that we have good sign of interest from our neighboring countries working together, and so the people should not be worried about that.
I do really appreciate your full comments, Dr. Adakanyan, and I wish you all the best in your career.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this edition of Face to Face. I'm Humane Abedi.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Hello and welcome back to The Light. A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic, colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming has used clay to make a sculpture of an ox, this year's symbol in the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It's almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says the piece aims to lift spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It's adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says he will put the ox in the public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
A German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
A 70-year-old English grandfather has become the oldest person to row across the Atlantic unassisted. Frank Rothwell broke the world record by completing the 3,000-mile journey in 56 days. Frank rowed from Tenerife in Spain's Canary Islands to Antigua. Such a feat had never been achieved by anyone as old. The septuagenarian sailed across the Atlantic with the aim of raising awareness about Alzheimer's disease and raising £1 million for a UK dementia research charity.
In the UK and other places, I've done a lot of sailing. I've sailed around the world. I've been here 3 or 4 times, sitting in my own yacht. I've sailed around North America, to within 900 miles of the North Pole. I've sailed around South America, around Cape Horn. I'm the only man in the world to sail all the way around America in a figure of eight. Nobody in the world has ever done that except me. There's only 10 people in the world, only 10 people ever sailed all the way around America. And I'm number 10, or I was 2 years ago. I've not looked up since.
Rothwell has sailed all over the world, including 3 previous journeys across the Atlantic. In 2017, he also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This shows that to be 70 years young is sometimes far more lively than to be 40 years old.
Well, no matter how old you are, music can always be mesmerizing. In France, a pianist is still addicted to the soft tune of her instrument at the age of 106. Here's more. Colette Mays is a pianist based in Paris. She was born before the start of the First World War and has been playing her favorite instrument for more than a century now. Colette has already released 5 music albums and is now recording her 6th one. The veteran musician says what attracted her to music was a desire for tenderness, which she lacked as a kid at her strict home environment.
In my family, I was raised by a very kind nanny. Mother was very strict. That's how it was at the time, and so I needed tenderness, which was normal. Above where we lived, there were lots of little boys who played the piano. They were always playing the same music. And as a baby, with one finger, I reproduced those melodies. My parents were surprised with that, because playing with dolls didn't amuse me, but playing notes on the piano did. That's why they made me start learning the piano early on.
Well, Colette's favorite musicians are Debussy, Chopin, and Schumann. She looks at the sky for inspiration and says music is more important to her than food. For most of her adult life, Colette has been a supporting piano player at Parisian schools. The dedicated pianist is still marvelously healthy at the age of 106.
Some might say pandas are natural born celebrities, and they are right. In China, Sichuan province, 10 panda cubs have made their first public debut with throngs of journalists and photographers watching their every move. All of the adorable creatures, which are not named yet, were born in 2020 at a Wolong Conservation and Research Center. Their age ranges from just 120 to 190 days. Each of the cubs has a weight of about 10 kilograms. Over the past year, a total of 44 panda cubs were born around the globe.
Madagascar is the land of outlandish creatures. Biologists have made another tiny discovery in the north of the island. Scientists say Bruchesia nana could be the world's smallest reptile. Also known as nanochameleon, the diminutive lizard measures less than an inch in length. That means it is as small as a sunflower seed and can fit on your fingertip. The reptilian may be tiny, but it has raised a lot of questions as to why it is this small compared to other vertebrates. Also, unlike most reptiles, female nanochameleons are larger than the males. The species is thought to be critically endangered due to mass deforestation.
An annual light festival lights up the Danish capital, Copenhagen, bringing color and life to the city amid the coronavirus pandemic. Architectural lighting, designs and pieces have adorned the city in the winter season, attracting many visitors. Some 30 light installations are located in and around the city, spreading on the bridges, buildings and squares. The organizers have planned two routes, each 3 kilometers long, so visitors can enjoy the festival while practicing social distancing.
A light festival in these dark times is very nice. It's some brightness in your life. You get stimulated through the art. And
this is the fourth year the Copenhagen Light Festival is taking place. However, this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, guided tours, talks and pop-up events have been cancelled. Instead, the organizers have prepared an interactive map so visitors can find routes and information about the installations.
An American artist has committed himself to drawing 50,000 bees on buildings around the world. Matthew Willey, who has painted murals for 25 years, came up with the idea after a bee buzzed into his room. His goal is to raise awareness about saving the little fuzzy insects. 50,000 is the number of bees in a healthy, thriving hive in nature. During the past 5 years, Willey has painted over 5,500 of the insects in 30 murals.
My goal has always been to be in every type of neighborhood in the world. So that would be all of the continents, all of, you know, I can't literally paint bees in every community, but to take a cross section and say, you know, in every type of place, these bees have been painted, because I'm really, even though it is a healthy hive of bees that visually will be painted, it's really us. I'm painting the human race into this collective hive.
Willey says many people have so far supported his project with their donations. He hopes that his murals prompt people to rethink their relationship with nature. Bees and other insects are constantly facing a range of threats, from the use of pesticides to habitat loss and climate change.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.